What's up, everyone? Welcome to the episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. I am your host, Neil Horwitz, the very first podcast of 2026 for the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. And we are starting out with a great one to get you set for the year. As always, you can find me on Twitter, NJ287, on LinkedIn, where I post more content, the website where you can find everything, dsmsports.net, and the podcast is available on whichever podcast platform is your favorite. We have an awesome show for you guys today to kick off the year. Someone who I've been reading for a while, have been wanting to connect with for a while. She's been on the list of hopeful guests, and I was able to grab her to help us kick off 2026. My guest on the podcast today is Alyssa Myers. She's a senior reporter for Marketing Brew. You have more than likely read some of her stuff if you're interested in the space. She writes a ton on Marketing Brew about sports in particular, among other subjects, but sports is what we'll focus on today, of course, for this podcast. And we talk a lot about what she's been seeing in the space, the various conversations she's had about campaigns, initiatives, what to look ahead for in 2026. Just so much good information, so much good insight, intel. So here she is. Listen up, Alyssa Myers of Marketing Brew. I am back on the podcast with today's guest. I'm so excited to be speaking with her. I feel like I read her words more often than anybody else in the world. She has covered so many great stories and has taught me a lot over the years. My guest on the podcast today is Alyssa Myers. She is a senior reporter for Marketing Brew. Welcome to the podcast today, Alyssa.
Hey Neil, thanks for having me on.
So psyched to pick your brain. You get to cover so many interesting stories and really, I'm sure, absorb a lot of knowledge and insight along the way and get to see like where we're going, where we're headed as an industry, from whether it's from sales or marketing or sponsorship or brand and all these emerging leagues and established leagues. There's so many great stories you get to cover. So I'm psyched to learn from you today and pick your brain today. But before we get in the meat of our discussion, tell us about you. Tell us about your background, how you came up in this career, and what you're doing today with Marketing Brew.
Yes, I will try to give you the elevator pitch short version because it can get quite long. I've always known that I wanted to be in news and reporting, be a journalist. I've loved to write since I was young and love talking to people, meeting new people. So it always seemed like a natural career path for me. I double majored in college. I studied journalism and advertising, which is a little bit how I ended up in the job I'm at now. I went to journalism school at Boston University, and it was a very traditional program there, though. So basically, all I was exposed to was breaking news, newspapers. That was my first couple of jobs, doing sort of like night, weekend shifts, and then more full time at newspapers. I started at the Boston Globe. When I graduated, I moved to Virginia to work at a local paper in Southern Virginia there, doing sort of the city council beat, crime, breaking news, courts, that sort of thing. I did really like it, but it's a tough gig. You don't get paid a ton, it's really fast moving, demanding hours. And I wanted to have a little bit more of a life on the side, and I wanted to live in New York. So that's how I sort of ended up in my career path now. Got a job, a fellowship with Business Insider on their advertising and marketing reporting team. And that sort of launched me to where I am now, covered marketing generally, for the 3 or 4 years. Ended up here, and about a year into my job here at Marketing Brew, we sort of said, what's missing in our coverage? I wanted a bit of a beat change. I had done a few sports stories just as sort of a matter of personal interest. I'm a huge sports fan. I've been an athlete my whole life. I play pickup soccer. I run pretty seriously. I am a competitive boxer. So it's a big part of my life. Did some of those stories. Readers seem to like it. So yeah, we made the sports marketing beat official here, and I've been doing that for a few years now.
And you kick ass at it, and now I know not to mess with you if I, in a dark alley because you will punch my lights out potentially.
Correct.
But I want to even like think about, and we talked about this a little bit offline before we started recording, of like what it's like to prepare for a career in journalism now, and like no one knows like where this is going. And even mentioned a little bit like it was preparing you for like the traditional life of a journalist that in theory hasn't changed since the early 50s, 60s, and the 80s, 90s, whatever. But it's much different now. So like, how do you feel like you were prepared, or and how can we get better as a system to prepare the media reporters, journalists, whoever you want to call it, of tomorrow? Like, tell me about your experience and what you saw was working and what is missing, sort of.
Yeah, that's a great question. I have a feeling that this is not the same case for everyone, but I can speak a little generally from my upbringing in media and journalism. Like I said, my experience was really traditional. There are things about that that are amazing. The foundation of working in a classic newsroom at a newspaper doing breaking news, it was quite literally a trial by fire. There was no better way to learn the basics of writing and reporting. But I think that when I sort of moved on in my career, when I looked back, what was lacking was definitely a little bit more of a modern approach. I think media and journalism is still a really old-fashioned business. Advertising to some extent too. There's a lot of nostalgia for like the Mad Men days. And even me, when I was in college, one of the reasons why I loved journalism was like I would watch All the President's Men, and like I wanted to meet a source in a parking garage. And that's just not really the way of the world anymore. I was not, we had a class, I think that was a prereq. It was like one course that I had to take called online journalism. And it was like, use your cell phone to take a picture, and like, here's how to upload to a website. Like, it was very, the existence of that class, I think, says a lot about the state of journalism education. So while I have a feeling there are, and that this was 10 years ago, but I think maybe there are still some programs like that. And I think that it's time for the older guard, at least. You gotta accept, like, news is on TikTok these days. News is on social media. That's real news. It's not all misinformation, and those are tools that reporters need to use. It needs to be more than just one class called online journalism. There needs to be, I think, a little more flexibility.
What do you think of being is the purpose, the goal of your journalism in particular, and maybe that's a little bit of an approach of the morning brew, marketing brew, approach as well. Like, is it just information dissemination? Is it wanting to have your own POV a little bit in there because it differentiates you a little bit? Is it meant to be teaching? And like, what's kind of your guiding principle as a journalist yourself?
Our philosophy, I think, across Morning Brew and especially Marketing Brew and the other B2B publications we have is that we want to make our readers smarter, and we want to do it in a way that is easy to digest, enjoyable. We've kind of been known for a little bit of a lighthearted style. We like to use some humor where appropriate. We are very anti-jargon. We want things to be put simply in normal human language. But we want the end result and the work cumulatively, and this is how I feel, to be really smart. I want to feel confident in it. I want my readers, who I have so much respect for, they're people who I admire their careers, CMOs of brands I love and teams and leagues I love. That's who's reading Marketing Brew. So the bar is really high because of that. And while we like to have fun with it, we are also one of the most principled, serious, tied up newsrooms I've ever been a part of. So there really isn't a ton of opinion. And I still, maybe that's a little old fashioned, but I do think, obviously, I have opinions. I try not to put them in my writing at all. I'm a traditional reporter. I don't think that my stories should reflect my opinion at all. They reflect the thoughts and the opinions of my sources. And they are all fact checked and copy edited like crazy. So a little bit of both ends of the spectrum.
No, I think making your reader smarter is certainly a strong principle to stand on, and it comes to fruition as a reader myself. So tell me
Cool.
about, like, it's interesting to hear your background. It's always down to me. I'll tell you like a mini anecdote. When I was working on the team side of myself, one of our team beat writers who worked for the local paper, he knew nothing. I was working, it was in ice hockey. He knew nothing about hockey before he started covering the hockey beat. He was like, came from like a basketball background, even like a news background. I was like, wow, it set up a light bulb for me, being like, it's just your reporters, and you can cover a beat, and you know how to do it, and those are transferable skills. So when you went from covering what you were doing in Virginia and then Boston before that, and then came into Mark and Brew and said, okay, I'm going to take on the sports beat. What is that process like? Like, how do you get, do you, and just in general, when it comes to covering a beat, do you have to kind of become an expert? Do you have to like understand how the business works, and let alone who to know and why to know them? Like, tell me about what it's like to really own a beat and all the work it takes just to get to the starting point.
Yeah, you definitely do have to become an expert on it. I think the caveat on that is that you don't have to do it immediately. That is something I sort of learned over the years, is to be transparent with where you're at. When I first started covering sports, it was helpful that I'd done a few sports stories. I was a fan. I'd played a lot of sports my whole life, so that was sort of like a soft in for me with a lot of people. But I was super upfront about the fact that I said, "Hey, this is brand new. I'm starting this beat. This is not a beat I've ever covered before." Hockey, weird that you mentioned that. That is still one of my like weak spot sports. Even though I
Come
went
on,
to
you
great
went to
hockey
BU. Yeah,
college,
it's a hockey
I know,
school.
I know. I watched so much hockey in college, and it just didn't stick really, and I'm the only sports reporter across Morning Brew, so I cover every sport. I try to know as much as possible about all of them. But this is all to say, when I don't, and when I first started, I'm super honest about that with whoever I'm talking to. I think that that is a good skill that a lot of reporters should have, is just like the ability to admit that, and it's not a shortcoming. Like, I will tell you what I don't know, because that's why I'm interviewing most people. You're the expert. You're here to teach me so that I could teach my readers. And I need to be honest with you about where I'm at. And if I'm not understanding something, like, I'm not going to pretend like I do, because then I can't write about it. So yeah, that was something I kept in mind when I was sort of building the beat. I was pretty lucky coming on the sports beat too, and I was covering a lot of women's sports, especially at a time like, I think it was 2022, even 23, when women's sports was really booming for the first time. There was a ton of stories there. It was just a little fortuitous to be writing about that. There was a lot of interest from people in that space in talking to me and teaching me, which was incredible to see. And that's where I started, really, was we hit on this a little earlier, how reporters and anyone who does interviews will have like a list of people they want to talk to. And that's how I started. I made a big list, a big Google sheet of people who I had read, who I had known about, teams and leagues that I looked up to or just was a fan of. Started reaching out, and you build the beat and the sources from there, and it takes years, but talking to those really smart people is how you become an expert and how you know what to write about.
Yeah, and this is probably a little bit of me geeking out and about this reporting beat in general, but like how do you know like where you want to go, what stories you want to tell, like in the quote unquote traditional sports news world? Like, okay, there's a trade deadline, there's free agency, there's a draft, there's playoffs, there's injuries or whatever. It's a lot more like just cut and dry about what you need to report on. But in the business world, like, well, you can, this team is doing something interesting, or this technology company is doing something interesting, or this, there's like media rights deals and stuff like that. It's more, I guess, general, news. But how do you know what stories you want to go after, what stories you want to chase, especially some of the more inside baseball, inside business stories?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. Some of it is that more traditional news pitching, or just, I'll do a lot of catch-up calls, coffees with sources that I've spoken to on the record in the past, just saying, hey, what's up? What are you thinking about? Especially this time of year, what are your goals? What are your plans for next year? If, three or four people say something similar, if I get three or four similar pitches, that's always been a really common way, a really easy way that I'm like, cool, this is a trend. This is something a bunch of people are doing right now.
Yeah.
Passion points for me, honestly. Like, I did a bunch of stories about marathon and fitness sponsorships this past fall,
Yeah.
because I was, doing a lot of races and trying to qualify for New York City Marathon next year, and I couldn't run this year because I'm hurt, but I just like was passionate about it, and I was in that space and I was spending time in gym. So I did this story about Hyrox race sponsorships because I was seeing that on my Instagram feed. So being in the world a little bit myself has been really helpful. And I love that about my job, is that if there's a team or a league or a sport that I'm playing or I'm watching and I'm really passionate about and I know it and I have an idea, I want to write about it, I can write about it. It's the best kind of story. It's super
Yeah.
fun. But yeah, there's also obviously a lot of the other more, I don't know, the more of a heavier lift, where it's stuff that I'm also reading other trade publications and, reading the news, following the news about things like trades and free agency and injuries and sponsorship mostly, and sort of putting that all together to form more of a bigger picture trend idea. That's usually
Yeah.
sort of how I look at my coverage.
It certainly sounds like you have the I we always joke at people that work in or have spent time in the sports business world that once you spend time in it, you will never see or experience a sports event the same way again. Like, you probably go to now 5Ks, you go to like a basketball game, and all you can see is like, oh, neat sponsor activation, or oh, like
Yeah.
that's a like it
It's
for
so
better or
true.
for worse, it's that's how it's gonna be for the rest of your life. But I
It's
hope
so
it's for the better.
true. Yeah, it's why I'm thankful I don't actually cover like sports in terms of the game. I'm not like a traditional sports reporter, I'm sports
Yeah.
business, because I can still go to the games and watch games and have that be not work, really.
Totally. So when you find like when you when, as you go and report these stories and talk to folks that are working on the team side, league side, media side, whatever, like Is it more, is there a pretty heavy PR machine where you are getting pitches saying, we want people to know about this cool strategy that we have, or we want people to know about the sponsor activation? Or is it just as much of you being interested in, and being proactive, being like, hey, that's cool that you're doing that. I want to hear the behind the scenes of how that came together. Like, what's that like, and how has it kind of evolved in your time covering the beat? Is there more of a PR machine, especially probably for those emerging sports and women's sports that want to get their story out there a little bit more proactively?
Yeah, I think there is more of a PR machine, not just for sports and emerging sports and women's sports, but just across the media ecosystem. I feel like this goes without saying, and a lot of people have heard this, but it's very true that there are more and more PR people. There are less and less reporters every day. And so if you're a journalist, you are, of course, just going to be inundated. I've always had a lot of really good friends who work in PR and at PR agencies. And so it's been a sort of passion point of mine to talk about this stuff and try to maintain good relationships. I think it does have to be a little bit of both. I've definitely done a ton of good stories based on a pitch. I think there has to be a give and take. Like, I will never write, I don't really take well to like suggested headline or like suggested questions. You know, I think you tell me what you want. If we're both honest with each other, I'm like, okay, this is cool. I like this, this, and this. This is what I think my readers will like. This is the way I want to go with that. Is that okay? So I think it's a little bit of a push and pull, and it has to be a collaboration. And then, you know, we both, everyone involved kind of feeds off each other. I am happy to do stories based on pitches if I can have a little leeway. And then in turn, I hope that we have a good enough relationship that, like I said, oftentimes I do come up with my own story ideas and I'll reach out to people and say, hey, I'm doing this feature about XYZ. I saw your brand did a campaign that fits in that trend. Can I talk to someone? And yeah, I think that, you know, it's really important to maintain those relationships.
And along those lines, like, what are sort of the narratives that you are seeing is also what's being pitched. Like, and I speak about this also in like the framing of what leagues and teams and brands like see as success. Like, we are reaching a younger demographic, or we're reaching a more diverse demographic, or look at us, like we are increase our sponsorship sales, or we increase our ticket sales, our season ticket sales, our group sales, whatever it might be. Like, what are some of these bigger pitch narrative stories that you are seeing, as well as what you're receiving?
Yeah, I think that you hit one right on the head with the next gen fan. I hear a lot about that, see a lot about that, write a lot about that. I think it's smart. I've been seeing it a ton, especially lately in motorsports. I think after what happened with Formula One in the US, even F1 and teams are still, I think, focused on, okay, we have this new audience. They're young, they're women, you know, they're from parts of the world that we have not reached before. They're here, they're interested. How can we make them a fan of our team? How can we make sure that they will wake up at 8 in the morning to watch a race in Abu Dhabi as opposed to just watching Drive to Survive? But I think other teams and leagues are doing the same. Baseball has been kind of an interesting one on that front because in my experience, I've talked to a handful of teams that are very focused on Gen Z, Gen Alpha, next gen fans, casual fans. But baseball historically is a little bit of a traditional sport. I think there are still teams that are slower to embrace change. So yeah, I think that you're right that that sort of like next gen fan and how teams and leagues can sort of capture their attention and get them to stick around is really top of mind for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's funny that people tend to forget sometimes that all these big sports that are making billions and billions are printing money. The median fan is like in their 50s, if not older. Like, if you get like to golf and baseball, it's even older. And it's like, okay, well, that's why I guess it's so desperate to show, like, yes, our median fan is really old, and let alone our average fan probably is even older if you type, get averages into account. But I guess that's why they want to show, like, we're not a dying brand. We are growing because we have the next generation of fans is coming, even if they're consuming the sport in a different way.
And fandom starts so young. People say that to me all the time when we have this conversation. Like, I think the sports marketers that are really knowledgeable about this do say things along the lines of like, we've done studies, we know fandom starts when you're 3, 4, 5 years old, super young. So why would we not think about a fan's journey from that young age?
And you mentioned Drive to Survive. There's any number of stories about the new avenues to fandom, I guess, and even what it means to be a fan. We could go on a whole other tangent about that too. And so, like, as you're starting to see this blend or these different avenues into fandom, whether it is through these docuseries or through partnerships with musicians or influencers or creators, or interesting brand activations as well. Like, what are some unique ways you're starting to see Brands help new fans get creative of sports with new ways that leagues and teams are trying to recruit fans, and even what that fan funnel is starting to look like, and what success looks like in these some of these fan development initiatives.
I love that question. There's so much there. There's so much to say in terms of the connections between lifestyle, entertainment, music, fashion, all that stuff, and sports. And I think there's some really exciting stuff going on. I am a huge fan of some of the docuseries and that approach. That is a strategy that speaks to me personally, is, the NFL's Helmets Off initiative. Every sort of team or league has some sort of version of that where they have realized that people, a lot of the next gen newer fans, are fans of the athlete. They want to know the athlete. They are more fans of the athlete than they are of the team. And that can be a pipeline into being a fan of the team. But you want that personal connection. I love that. I think that's good. I think everyone is trying. I heard so much this year from probably every team or league CMO I talked to, like, oh yeah, and we have this docuseries. It's going to be like Draft to Survive, but for XYZ sport. That one, I don't think is ever replicable again, but I think it's still worth doing this kind of content. I'm so excited about what brands and teams and leagues are doing with mascots lately. That has been such a fun story for me to follow because I do think that brands can play a role in developing the profile of a more rising team or league or sport. There's been some really cool campaigns with mascots, and I think that's so fun. Partnerships with musicians, fashion collabs, I think have been really cool. The NFL's, new partnership with Abercrombie this season. It's been amazing to see merch across the board get a little bit cooler, more stylish. I don't just have to wear, some big jersey that's not made for a woman. Like, I can spend money on a really cool jacket from my favorite team or, something like that. So there's just so much exciting stuff going on.
No, lots of good stuff to hit on there. And like the mascots, I mean, I think TikTok really helped elevate a lot. Like some of the earliest TikTok stars were like Benny the Bull and BYU Cougar. And of course, like what we've seen with Ellie the Elephant, and just mind blowing of like, we never thought about like making a feminine mascot. And now all of a sudden she has like her own deals with like cosmetic and jewelry companies or whatever. It's so cool to see. But also just speaking about that, those brand extensions and those, merch drops and different collaborations, like what does this mean to be a fan? Like, are we ultimately creating fans of the brand because, hey, they want to wear our cool gear, and that's like, at least we get them in the door of them. We get them in our database, and we can try to, convert them, monetize them in different ways. Like, I guess maybe when I was born, before you were born, like if being a fan meant you watched games or you followed the team or you went to games or whatever it is. But now, like, it just means so many different things. And so, like, what are like the conversions? Like, what does it mean to convert someone to a fan now? Like, if they wear your merch, or if they follow your athlete, or if they, are watching your mascot on YouTube or on TikTok or whatever. Like, what are the finish lines look like nowadays?
Yeah, I think it's so different and so much harder to track. I had a team or league CMO say to me recently, obviously something along the lines of like ticket sales are great, butts in seats are great. Social followers just as an important of a metric, specifically even when we're talking to brands and sponsors. Like, teams can sell huge sponsorships based on their social following, based nothing to do with who's coming, who's watching. So I think that that is an increasingly important metric for sports organizations, is just kind of straightforward, but engagement follows, stuff like that on social. The merch thing, I think, is a little newer. I kind of have the sense that people are less caught up in that, or maybe they're not tracking it as well, or they don't know how to. But I think that that is a next level fandom. Like, I have team gear that I have spent upwards of $100 on. That's like some of my favorite clothes that, like, I'm really repping, and like I will continue to do that. So I think that's sort of like growing on the profile of a lot of sports marketers. And I think that's something that's indicative of like a really engaged fan. Attendance and viewership and stuff like that is still important. But yeah, I think all of this stuff that's harder to quantify and harder to track, like, if someone follows an athlete on the team, but not the team itself, or if they watch a video of the mascot, there's just so many more ways to show your fandom, which makes it, I think, harder for marketers to track and follow, but not impossible.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, these are culture building machines, these are media machines, and like Someone might be a fan of a show or an actor, but it doesn't mean they have to be like a Netflix diehard fan or whatever. It's a, I mean, that's a poor analogy, but I'm grasping it at straws for a little bit. But there's something to that of like exporting a brand like PSG wants to be this upper luxury brand that it's aspirational. And there's fans in like Brazil or Europe who are wearing New York Yankees hats that have no idea it's a baseball team or whatever. And like that's a whole different way to like ultimately monetize the brand and get to be aspirational as well. And you touched on the athletes moving the needle, which is, you know, nothing new now. I think we kind of have all realized that athletes are where a lot of fans come into the door and who they want to relate to more. But I want to talk about that maybe in the context of a greater story of what has driven the rapid growth of women's sports. And we can point to Caitlin Clark. We can point to the WNBA rise overall. We can point to Olympics. We can point to college athletics. I guess, first off, what have you seen be the elements behind the increased popularity of women's sports? What have been the factors behind those big booms? And kind of like alluding to that a little bit too of like how have the fluency of women's athletes and is the also the online nature of their fan of the early fans have helped drive that boom over the last few years?
I can talk about this for literally hours. I'm gonna try to say like 2.5 things on it maximum. I think the first thing that always feels worth mentioning when people talk about the rise of women's sports is the talent. I feel like there's a lot of conversation around people being kind of surprised. Like, where did all this talent come from? Where did Caitlin Clark and her generation of basketball players come from? Like, look at all these young stars on the US women's national soccer team. I don't think that any of that should be surprising. It is not a coincidence that that generation of women who are, just graduating college now, that is the first generation that grew up always. Like, look at the WNBA. The WNBA played its first season in 1997. Caitlin Clark and girls her age are the first generation of women who were born into a world where playing professional basketball was a reality, was a possibility. So, how do you expect to have an amazing talent pipeline before that era when girls were born and maybe they loved to play basketball, but it was literally impossible for them to make a career out of it? Like, this is not a coincidence. So we're there now. It's awesome that we're in that world. And I think that's a huge part of it. You have to have the talent, it has to be feasible, and now it is. I think the other part of it is that for a long time, when these leagues like the NWSL and the WNBA were newer, they did not get the media attention that they get today, and they still don't get perhaps as much media attention as they deserve or as a league like the NFL or the Big Four do. But they had to make their own platforms, in a world where it used to be, right? If you wanted to hear about an athlete, if you wanted to watch an interview, see what they had to say, you had to watch ESPN. You had to read an article where they were interviewed, or like the media was the only
The gatekeeper.
intermediary between fans and athletes. They weren't giving a platform or any attention to these women athletes, so they had to do it themselves. They had to become incredibly social media savvy early on. They had to start their own podcast because they were not getting invited on, I won't name any specific ones, but the popular ones. They had to do it for themselves. They had to become really good at it. Now they are amazing at it, and they do have a little bit more attention from the more traditional platforms. And I think the combination of both of those things has contributed to just like this explosion that seems like all of a sudden, but was probably a long time coming.
Yeah, you alluded to it earlier too about like how the your ability to have online clout and social clout as a league or as a team is a big part of the value prop you have to brand partners and others in the world now. And the women have nailed that from the beginning because they've had to. They didn't have any other choice. And in general, I think social media is a little bit more like females have are generally more savvy and female athletes are generally more savvy. And that has contributed, that has only, ex not exacerbated is the wrong term, but has amplified that effect as well. And I think what's interesting too, and you can speak this better than I can, but the influx of new brands and new different types of activations has been super astounding to see in the women's sports world. Like I always joke with that, who knew that Sephora was just waiting with a huge sports marketing budget, being like, we want to spend here, let alone like feminine hygiene products. And it's even just existing brands who are activating in new ways. Like, so what are you seeing in that world of new brands, new partners, new activations, and new opportunities to work with sports leagues and teams that we hadn't seen before?
Yeah, it's been amazing to follow, and I feel like I started getting into covering and reporting on this stuff at just the right time, the most exciting time where some of the most ingenious new ideas were sort of coming out. I think there was kind of like a first guard of support for women's sports. You still hear a ton about Ally Financial. Like they, man, such a smart early move. They invested so heavy so early that now they are synonymous with women's sports and everyone else will have to play catch up with them for the rest of time. And they're like one of the only brands I think that will never have to again like prove that they're authentic, like buzzword, sorry, but
Andrea Brimmer or Zimmer, like she's like literally
yeah.
like she's a women's sports hall of fame forever for her.
Yeah, for sure. And she it was interesting because at her time, like she was a D1 soccer player. So there was a lot, I think, of like CMOs of her sort of, I don't know if generation is the right word, but like a group of women, I think, CMOs of brands who sort of rose at this time where they were able to play D1 sports in college. Maybe they were Olympic athletes. They didn't really have a pipeline after that, but sports was clearly amazing for them because they became these great business leaders. They knew firsthand that sports sponsorship and women's sports sponsorship could be valuable. So I think some of them led the way. Like Ally is not the only financial company that's done this. I feel like State Farm is such a big sports vendor that got into women's sports early. MassMutual, like all these sort of financial insurance companies have always had huge sports budgets. And they started spending on women's sports at a good time. And now I feel like we're kind of moving into a space where more, you don't just have to be a CMO who played a D1 college women's sport to see the value. Like it's not just personal experience. There's more of a business case now where you do see the sort of like new era brands like beauty brands, Sephora, Essie, like making these sports deals. And Sephora now working with the Warriors too, right? Not just the Valkyries. Like they're in the NBA, which I think is so cool and makes sense. Like they're not just selling, I don't know, mascara. Like they do skincare stuff. There's definitely demand for skincare among men. We see male athletes now like wearing nail polish, talking about skincare, talking about makeup. Like there is a market for that. So it makes perfect sense to me. Never mind the fact that women are basketball fans as well, are NBA fans. So yeah, I could go on, but I will pause.
Are you seeing and are brands understanding this and teams for that matter too? Like, are these net new sports fans? Like, I think something I always come back to is the Golden State Valkyrie story about how like their season ticket holders are have little
Yeah.
to no intersection with the Warriors season ticket holders. And it's like, holy crap, these are new fans that weren't fans before. So like, are you seeing that these brands and these teams that are they recruiting new sports fans into the sports in the fandom fold, or is it still like a lot of just male fans who are picking, or not just male fans in general, but like fans who are already have their team and now they have a women's team. Like, what do you see in that space, and what are brands looking for in that space?
I think it's so dependent. Like, I think that will differ not just sport to sport and league to league, but team to team, market to market. A lot of it depends on the market. Like, are you, if you're a new soccer team, are you in a traditional soccer market or, do people not know so much about it? I think that that's where some market research could come into play, or at least a little bit of like casual fan polling. Like, you gotta know where you are, what the demos are, because I think it will be different. I think there are some definitely fans who, maybe it's women who grew up with huge sports fandom and they're big, like talk about Denver, they're getting an NWSL team. Maybe you got people there, not just women who are huge sports fans, they're Denver Nuggets fans or whatever. Like there's a big sports culture there. They're already indoctrinated. They're probably like, great, here, we got a soccer team now. I think there's potential also, for fans who aren't so much into sports, but maybe they soccer's so accessible. Maybe they played when they were young and they haven't thought about sports for 2 decades now. But how do you get them into the fold? I really don't think there's like a one size fits all answer. I think there is a way to make anyone a sports fan.
Totally, and we're seeing it. And along, like, kind of a jumping off that, or piggybacking off a little bit, some of the work that you do that I really enjoy reading is, and I just geek out about the space of these emerging sports. And I know we just talked about women's sports just for a while now, but the Women's Hockey League, or the lacrosse, or pickleball, or cricket, or mass participation sports like running that you mentioned, like. How are these smaller leagues, jumpstart leagues, emerging leagues getting on the radar? What kind of creative things are you seeing out there? Is it the takeover tour type stuff, or is it like giant activations like in the middle of Times Square doing something that you can't help but get attention? Is it influencers? Like, what are you seeing to get these newer and emerging sports on the radar of the mainstream, I guess?
Yeah, so much good stuff being done there. And it's worth noting that some of the growth of these leagues, like the PWHL you mentioned, some of these volleyball leagues, they're 2, 3 years in. That it's nothing. Like, even to compare them to other women's sports properties that have been around for 20, 25 years, like, they are so new. Think about when the NFL was 2 years in. Like, it's so crazy to even, there's no comparison. And that just always feels worth mentioning when I talk about the growth of emerging leagues and sports that, like, they're so young, and anything at this point is impressive. Like, give them another 10 years and then we can really talk. But there's been some really cool stuff. I think brands do play a role, like doing innovative brand partnerships with big name companies that have an audience, even if it's not like fandom, like a sport. But I think there's something to be said for that. I think some of the more like lifestyle entertainment partnerships are really cool. In the influencer vein, like you think of music, there are like, yeah, creators in the music space, creators in the fashion space, creators in the food space. I've seen a lot of teams sort of like invite those people outside of sports, invite them in, have them come to a game. They do content that now their followers who maybe only care about fashion, now they're saying like, oh, hey, cool, like we can go to this game and wear this merch. And it's a whole new, type of fan that you've unlocked. I think that a lot of organizations have had a lot of success going that route with something a little more unexpected, whether it's a brand partner, an influencer partner, whoever, just branching out and getting new fans that way.
Yeah, oh, that's great. I'll tell you too. Just a few minutes left here with Alyssa Myers. She's a senior reporter for Marketing Brew. I think her and I can geek out on stuff all day, and we might just do so. One of my favorite things you've written over the years it was an interview with I don't know if I'm pronouncing your name correctly, but Shanna Stevenson with the New York Liberty.
Oh,
And
yeah.
I mentioned that because it was a great insight into what it meant to build a brand of a team. And we're seeing now it kind of a piggyback off that last point around these new teams, new leagues. We see like you have to create these new brands from scratch. And like so I want to kind of pick your brain a little bit about what's working. Like, what are the considerations that come into play when you are establishing a brand for a team, whether it's trying to be really local focused because you want to sell that gate, or maybe kind of the opposite of that, where you want something that's going to be that you can build a global brand off of. And we can speak to like we saw like the Boston NWSL team kind of have a bit of a whiff there in their first attempt at building a brand, but and they came back in a stronger way. So good on them for recognizing that. So as you see these new teams come along, Denver you mentioned too as a new team coming along. Like what are some of the considerations that go into launching a brand, the elements that will make a brand strong and whatever that means, and how you go about actually putting that into action?
Oh, yes, so much there too. I love writing about this kind of stuff, the branding or rebranding of a new team, of a legacy team. It's so fun. I've done so much on it. I want to do more in the new year. We were actually just talking with my editor about formalizing more of like a series around this stuff, because it's been such a cool through line of my reporting lately. And there's so much to say. Yes, that story, the profile of Shayna Stephenson that you mentioned, who's the chief brand officer of the New York Liberty, shout out Shayna, that was such a cool example of a team that needed a full rebrand because, it was a time when the WNBA, a lot of teams, including the Liberty, were suffering, honestly. They're playing in Westchester County, where the NBA G League teams were playing in a rec center. Like, they got sold a bunch, moved around before they ended up in Brooklyn. At Barclays, they needed a total overhaul. And obviously, the brand is amazing now. And one of the things that they did when they were doing that rebrand that has been invaluable for them was Ellie creating their mascot and making her a personality and like really building her out. That's one thing that worked for them as they were sort of rebuilding. I mentioned Denver because I have a story about them up right now that I'm working on. And you are so right that like the Boston NWSL team was such an example of how this stuff can quite frankly go really wrong, and it's almost a good sign, like if I want to spin it that way, because fans are so passionate about their teams and leagues. Like, as much as brand marketers will say, oh, we have fans of the brand, like they love us, like you won't run into this kind of stuff if you're rebranding PepsiCo or a CPG like that. You run into it with local teams that people love so much, and something that Denver Summit FC has been doing from the very beginning is having that fan input from their president, said fan input from everything, including the brand values, down to like the color of the logo, what the logo looks like, the name of the team. They did a poll where people can vote on that. Having that community input, like, I think that is a really strong strategy. You see a lot of teams sort of pull from past history. Williams F1 team is in the middle of a big rebrand, and you know, their new logo is meant to be modern, but it's also a callback to their first ever W logo. And that's sort of another strategy, is merging your history if you're a really storied team with some more modern twists. So yeah, I think there's just like a ton of teams that are doing really innovative stuff here.
Yeah, and I think an interesting contrast to that too is like if you think about the difference between a brand or a team that is tied to a city and you can embrace the local culture and a versus like I think about what like the club's unrivaled what does it mean to be a fan of the I might get the name team names wrong like the Breeze or the Lunar or whatever it is like am I be picking a team because my favorite players on the team and I think eventually they do want to maybe build out the cities kind of like the PL the Premier Lacrosse League structure or they started out with just regular names and then they went to like New California Redwoods is my team now so like is that a different like how do you see a team like a club like Unrivaled or some of these leagues that are just kind of getting started from scratch without city specific locations, like how are they finding how are they I guess man, not just single out Unrivaled alone, but is that a different calculus I guess to develop fans when there isn't that obvious local connection?
Yeah, I think there is, and I think it's incredibly feasible for so many reasons. I mean, look at the Premier League. Look at how many like Man City fans live in the US. It's like, I think there's some stat that there's like 90% of Man City fans don't live in the UK. Like, it's you do not have to have that tie. I think Premier League is an amazing example of that. And I think, you know, we already talked about how important connections with athletes are. Like, of course, in this day and age, you can build a team brand and have people root for your team just based on the athletes, not based on the city. It's sort of like the Athletes Unlimited model as well. Like, they're another one that's kind of doing this. And yeah, you definitely don't have to. I mean, I am someone who, I talk about this a lot, my own personal fandom. I grew up not with a ton of sports fandom. I went to Yankees games growing up. That was really about it. My parents were not huge sports fans. I didn't get into sports until really I was an adult. I started playing fantasy football, and then I was like, okay, I got more into watching the NFL, and I watched Drive to Survive, and now I will wake up and watch F1 races. Like, I have come into sports fandom in so many different ways. And sometimes you have to pick a team. Like, you're not gonna grow up with, everyone isn't gonna grow up born into fandom. You don't always pick a team based on where you live. People move around. So yeah, I think there's just a lot to be said about building a brand for a sports team that isn't solely tied to, you know, the market or geographically speaking, because especially look at the media landscape we're in now. Like, we're not doing RSNs anymore. Everything is streamed. Like, you can watch whatever team from whatever city. So yeah, I think it's forward looking.
Yeah, that's spot on there with the local broadcast, like not dictating who you can watch and who you can follow. It dates me to realize that like you couldn't just watch every game; you had to watch whatever was put on in your local area, and it was a lot different then. And you alluded to the these global clubs, like some of the Premier League clubs, and it's interesting to think that like yes, there is some sort of like brand sort of if you pick to be a Man City fan or a Manchester United fan or an Arsenal fan or a Liverpool fan or a Tottenham Spurs fan, whatever it might be. Like, what are you starting to see in this in the greater industry of US of non-US clubs as well around what they're doing to cultivate global fans and not just like how to win those fans through localized strategies. Certainly want to hear your take on that as well and what you're seeing, whether it's through brand partnerships or influencers, creators, whoever it might be, but also like what the business models look like, what the business propositions look like, how they're ultimately going to monetize these remote fans.
Yeah, there is again a lot to say there. I think social media is a big part of it that a lot of these more international leagues are sort of looking at, you know, not just F1, but there are other race circuits, motorsports, other sports that compete around the world internationally in different cities. And I think they're using social, obviously, you know, they're doing live streams on YouTube. They are making that stuff really accessible, making sure that their streams are easy to access. They're where fans are. You know, you got to show up wherever your fans are. So they're looking and saying, okay, are our fans on Twitch? Are they on Instagram Reels? Like, where should we put this stuff so that fans can watch it? They're clipping and like putting value behind highlights and saying, okay, people maybe don't want to watch the whole game. Maybe they can't because they're in a different time zone. That's perfectly fine. We're going to post a ton of highlights. If you only want to watch the highlights, that's okay. That's valuable. If you convert into buying a ticket or watching live from that, amazing. But if you don't want to do that, that's okay, I think is the approach that a lot of marketers are taking. And I think the business case for it is integral. Like I think a lot of women's soccer when I think about the business of international sport because I'm a fan, but also that's a big conversation in terms of the player talent right now is like women star US stars that are based here, they can get paid a lot more money if they go play in the UK. And some of the biggest stars are, and there's big disputes over their contracts now to keep them in the NWSL and vice versa. There are international superstars who are, huge, huge, huge in their countries and on their national teams. Barbara Banda, Marta, like all these people who play in the NWSL. So you have to, and you can, like that league can monetize their fans in other countries. And you just have to, like, because of that baseline reason that the talent is, crossing countries more and more, I think.
A little bit of like, I want your informed opinion here, and not necessarily, you can speculate too, like, will the sponsors tend to follow the athletes more than like if Sophia Wilson had gone overseas, or if Trini Robin decides to go to, the WSL instead of staying to NWSL, like, will that dictate, will a sponsor follow her to the WSL team? All of a sudden they'll be like supporting Arsenal or whatever, a Lyon if she goes to France, or right, versus staying with the team. Like, how these dynamics affect the way that brands are thinking about how they're going to enter these sports and reach these fans.
They very well might. I think that that could be a very smart move, like following an athlete to a different team or league. I think that that could be really smart. Yeah, following an athlete somewhere. It reminds me of like when NIL was kind of new and there were some really forward-looking brands at the time who were saying like, okay, how cool would it be if we could sign an athlete when they're in high school or when they're in college, and then we could continue to sponsor them if they make it big. So I think there's a lot to be said for a brand that could tell that story and go with the athlete. I think it obviously depends on their KPIs and things like that. Like, are you even an international brand? Do you have an audience in the UK? If you're not sold there, then probably okay, you're not going to follow that athlete overseas. But I think there is a lot of opportunity there and potential if it makes sense for your goals, and if your deal is structured that way. And I could definitely see sponsor saying, hey, the big talent, they're not here anymore. They're in this other league. We're going to go evaluate that. If the audience lines up, the demographics line up, they think they can meet their goals that way, then yeah, why wouldn't you follow them?
Yeah, because ultimately, there's so many reasons you might want to support a team or league. It's the best athletes are there. Therefore, it's the elite. Like, you think about even the Gainbridge USL, a women's championship league, versus the NWSL. Like, where do brands spend their time? And they can look at overall eyeballs. They can look at individual athletes. They can, go on the team front and look at the cities they're trying to get into. So it's different. So many different variables that might go into play there. And I think that the NIL connection and college connections is an interesting analogy to think about too, because we're still just figuring that out as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Just a couple more things here before we start with that. I promise I will stop rambling on in a moment, Alyssa. But I want to talk about the next couple of years. In 2026, we have the Winter Olympics, and we have World Cup. And we have obviously everyone is still looking about LA 28, although I think we're getting ahead of ourselves. Like, let's enjoy 2026, 2027 first. But
No.
everyone is looking forward. They just want to, skip the next 2 years and go to the LA Olympics. So when we have everyone keeps talking about, oh, this is going to change everything. Like, we're gonna like, this is a chance for soccer to finally have its moment in the US for the third or fourth time when we've made that statement, I guess, or whatever. So, like, when you think about what are you seeing brands in terms of how they're preparing for these big events? What does success look like? And what is going to be the difference between, having that transformational moment and it just being a big campaign for a couple of weeks and then, going off back to the status quo?
Yeah, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head right there at the end when you said, a campaign just for a couple weeks. I mean, the brands that I have been following the strategy of when it comes to something like a World Cup or, Winter Olympics coming up, I've been talking to them about this stuff for a year or two already now. Like the companies that usually I think have the most success at these big international events where the audience is huge, but so is the number of brands there. It's so hard to break through. The ones that really do it right and do it well do not just show up, in the week before and then during the event and then the week after and then they go away. Like they have been partners with however you can do it. Doesn't have to be FIFA, US soccer, team partner, individual athlete partners. They're doing soccer work at a grassroots local level. They've been building fields and communities that need them for years. The companies basically, I think, that have thought about this stuff for at least a year, have shown up for at least a year in the run up to the event, and have activated not only, I mean, obviously, if you can afford a FIFA sponsorship, that's amazing, do it. But I think the other success strategy is like you have to layer on top of that with some more local stuff, local communities, especially now with how many host cities in the US alone are there? There's like a
Right.
dozen where the World Cup is going to be. So it's not enough to just, say official whatever of FIFA on your packaging. You have to be in a community, and ideally for a long time before and after the event that you're talking about.
How far in advance are will brands have to start thinking about Olympics, like for LA 28? Let alone, I'm not talking about Milan Cortina, but for the Olympics, and like how massive of an investment that, and how feasible is it for a smaller brand to even get involved? Or do you really have to, is it really just, I mean, they're obviously the tops, the official Olympic partners or whatever, but like what do those kind of campaigns look like, and how do they come together?
They're definitely thinking about them now. A lot of the people that I've talked to about Winter Olympics are already like, okay, yeah, maybe we don't have it all ironed out for LA yet, but we are ready to hit the ground running for LA as soon as the Winter Olympics are done. That stuff, the big stuff, is obviously being sold now. I mean, a huge storyline in sponsorship is that LA 28 is doing venue naming rights.
Yeah.
Those are blocked, those are getting sold, those are locked up. Like that stuff is being done deal being sold now. That is not to say though that if you are a smaller brand you can't do anything around the Olympics and it can't be a little bit more last minute. I think athlete partnerships is like such a straightforward approach. Kind of a hit or a miss, but like there are always these stories that you can never guess who it's going to be, but there are these overnight stars that come out of the Olympics and it's
Yeah.
worth taking an educated guess on maybe who you think that might be. And if you can start doing that now, if you're a smaller brand, you can start looking for LA. Like, what are the athletes you want to work with? That's incredibly feasible. And some of these Olympic athletes, I mean, it should cost more than it does to work with them, but because some of them only get attention, once every 4 years, it's reasonable in terms of the budget to do some of these athlete partnerships, and there's a chance that they really explode. So yeah, I would say go for that.
Yeah, you almost want to, like, you can use a little bit of Moneyball and then data analysis and, like, sort of predict, like, who's going to be an outsized investment. If we start investing now, that we're going to get make back our investment, 100x, let alone some of the, like you mentioned, some of the docuseries. Like, if you want to tell the story of the path to the Olympics, you got to start filming now, and get those
Totally.
early days of, Sha'Carri Richardson training for Noah Lyles, let alone some of the swimmers, and, obviously all the stars that will come out of that as well. Last thing before you share with Alyssa, I promise, is kind of looking ahead to 2026. And I was excited to have you on because this time of year, because we are at this turn of the calendar, and there's who knows what's going to happen, what the biggest stories are going to be in the year coming forward. So what are you looking for? What are some of the stories that you're most excited about? And what are some of the things that you are kind of speculating on right now as well?
Yes, you were getting a sneak peek at another story that I'm working on now, which is obviously my predictions piece. But this year,
Love it.
my question to mostly agency folks, but some of the like sponsorship analytics execs as well, was what's overlooked? What are sponsors, what are brand marketers overlooking in sports right now? So this is a mix of my opinions, their opinions. I will not attribute any of this to anyone in particular because that would be too hard, but you can see it in the story when it comes out. I've talked a little bit about motorsports. I think that is going to continue to boom. Someone smarter than me was like, yeah, F1 still, but look at the back of the grid. You don't only have to partner with a McLaren or a Ferrari or a Mercedes. Like, there are teams that are up and coming. McLaren hadn't been a winning team for decades before they started doing super good. And the team, the brands like Hilton, like MasterCard that worked with them for years have this amazing story now that they can tell about how they supported this team like through the hard times. So yeah, someone said F1, but look at the back of the grid, maybe if you don't have the biggest budget and there's still opportunities there. Other motorsports that people mentioned to me, IndyCar, MotoGP, which is motorcycles. Someone was talking about Monster Jam, which is crazy. They have some crazy social stats and apparently are really popular with families and kids. So that could be a really fun opportunity for someone in the motorsports world. Flag football is a really big one that I've been hearing a
Oh.
ton about. Flag is going to be in the Olympics in 2028, so that is a real up and comer. The way that soccer kind of has been, and I think that that continues to be an opportunity. International soccer, like we talked about, like maybe partnering with some of those international stars who play in the NWSL or vice versa.
Yeah.
Coaches, even like a lot of people mentioned coaches to me, especially soccer, especially Emma Hayes. Like, why don't some of these really famous coaches have sponsorships?
Yeah.
That could be super cool. I think I mentioned to you the story I did about HYROX, which is like the fitness race, basically. I think a lot of people have heard about it at this point, but fitness sponsorships, like run clubs, marathons, things that are a little bit more related to like the gym side of sports, I think is a really good opportunity in the new year. And then some of these up and coming like new league models, like we talked about, like Unrivaled, but not just Unrivaled. Project B, I think, is the other new
Right.
basketball league. We talked about Athletes Unlimited, PWHL, these volleyball leagues, pickleball leagues,
Yeah.
and especially some of these ones that are being run a little bit differently, you know, owned by athletes. It's not just like the sponsorship model that's different. These are different businesses. And I think that that can give more flexibility and some more opportunities for sponsors.
Totally. Love all that. I'm grinning a mile wide because I love this stuff. And heck, I almost want to go on tangent of like athlete-led brands and that in that sense too. There's a
Oh,
whole lot
yeah.
there. But we'll save that to the next time. But fantastic stuff. But we'll be right back to episode Herbal Stat, and then we'll have some more fun with our sidebar segment. So here's episode Herbal Stat coming up right now. Man, it's such good stuff. I could seriously geek out with Alyssa for hours, for days on end. Someone who I really enjoyed speaking with. And you're going to hear more from her in our sidebar segment. Stick around for that because there's more good info and insight and some fun stories and anecdotes as well. But first episode's Shareable Stat. And this episode's Shareable Stat is about YouTube and podcasts. Pretty astounding stat here I'm going to share with you. So in October 2025, it was reported that the number of hours of podcasts in the past year was over 700 million watched on YouTube via TV. So via the TV app for YouTube, not just on YouTube, you know, on app or on the website, on TV. And that's up from 400 million a year earlier. So that is 700 million in a single month, up from 400 million the same time period a year earlier. So 300 million more of podcast hours on TVs via YouTube is just an astounding number overall, and not to mention the growth as well. So what can we do with that stat? What can we do with this information? We're already seeing, of course, you know, more platforms invest in podcasts. You know, certainly you've likely seen the news about Netflix investing with Barstool Sports and with The Ringer and with iHeartMedia. More and more organizations are creating a video podcast is the thing, which is why this podcast is video as well. But how can you take advantage of this if you are a sports organization, you're a sports league, a sports media company? You know, podcasts are already part of the media diet, the media, you know, production operation, where and typically talking about whether it's interviews with alumni or talking about X and O's or, you know, talking about the news of the day. But how can we also take advantage of the fact that there's so much podcast being displayed on TVs through YouTube in particular, but really just in general as well? You know, a lot of times just background content. You know, I was certainly astounded to see recently as well a fireplace, a YouTube of a fireplace burning for 10 hours straight, had nearly 200 million views on YouTube, which is just insanity. And the fact that people just want something on that screen in the background, you know, whether that is a podcast or a fireplace. So what can you do to provide that background content for your fans? You know, I mean, shoot, could it be a radio or TV broadcast from classic games of yesteryear? Can it be ongoing profiles or interviews? How can AI help you to create things? Could it be compilations of great plays over the years or from the past season or whatever it might be? What is that background content? How can you take advantage of those 700 million hours that are being streamed on TVs via YouTube for video podcasts? It's an astounding thing to think about. So that's some shareable stat. Think about it, talk about it, take action on it, experiment with it, have fun with it. But more importantly, stick around because more good stuff coming from Alyssa Myers of Marketing Brew. Right back for this episode's Shareable Stat, and I'm joined once again by Alyssa Myers. She is the senior reporter for Marketing Brew. Alyssa, you kicked ass in your interview section. Are you now ready to do a few sidebars?
I am so ready. Let's do it, Neil.
All right, let's see if you can match like the boss Bob Ryan, Jackie McMullen, name your famous Boston reporters. All right. Number one, you mentioned being at BU and working on the paper there, among other things. So tell me the most memorable story you worked on while you were a student at BU.
I worked on so many memorable stories. There was one sports one that I did. I had done some stories about the Boston Marathon, and I got to do that on the ground, which was incredible. It was before I knew I was going to be a sports reporter. But I did one piece about the push rim and the wheelchair races, and sort of like the difference between them. And I got really into like the nitty-gritty of that and had some of those athletes and executives explain sort of the ins and outs of that element of the marathon to me, which I found so cool. It's really stuck with me to this day. And man, I did some crazy city council stories when I was in Boston. Any sort of city council is going to have some things come out of it. I remember I was at one city council meeting that I think ran over of 3 hours. And it was just about how in the Fenway area, there was like an abundance of, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear, but there was like geese shit all over Fenway, basically. And they had a 3 hour city council meeting about like, man, like, what are we gonna do about all this geese poop? They talked about like bringing in dogs to herd the geese. It was unhinged. The meeting went on for 3 hours, and I remember it concluded with like, we still don't know. We'll try again later.
See, and when you brought up to like working in Virginia, as well as that story right there about the city council, like, are we losing that local news beat around the country outside of the major cities? Like, who's reporting on geese shit in Lincoln, Nebraska, or something? Let alone smaller cities like Jackson, Mississippi. What's gonna happen to those stories? They're just not gonna get told.
Yeah, I think so. I think we are losing that, and I think it is tragic and it's a shame. There's not funding for it. Like I knew people when I worked at the Virginian Pilot who worked there for 30 years and they never got a raise or a promotion, and they were still making 30K a year, which like you can live on in Southern Virginia, but there's not like the money's not there, and a lot of people think of journalism as kind of a nonprofit job, but it's a job like people have to pay for it. You have to pay for the news reporters have to get paid. It's not a nonprofit like kindness of your heart kind of job. There is a big like element of civic responsibility. But if we want these stories, which I think people should, like we got to pay the local reporters to do them, and the business around local news is just like so broken.
Well, that's a downer a bit, but
Sorry.
it's a stark reality. That's why I wanted to bring it up. So let's get back to number two. It should be a fun one, because when I found about this fun fact about you, I was so excited to ask about it. You, among other things you did at BU, you gave tours and were a campus ambassador in some sense. So tell me, just what it was like giving tours, or what was your favorite fun fact to share on tours, and what was the weirdest or most like unusual question like a parent or student asked you?
Yeah, I love this. I loved being a tour guide and an ambassador. I worked in the admissions office all 4 years at BU, mostly because I love to talk and I love to hear myself talk. And when you're given a tour, they just like give you a microphone and people listen to you and you get to walk around and talk about yourself. And
And walk
mostly I did
backwards. You
that.
get really good at walking backwards, right?
I could do the backwards walking, and there were some facts about the school that I had to give, but mostly I was like, this is where I hang out. Like, that's my friend. Like, it was the Alyssa Myers tour of Boston University. There was this one story that I really liked to tell that was like school sanctioned. BU is like a really rural urban campus. We had this like one strip of grass that was kind of on the Charles River, but also there was like a highway right by it. They had us, the story that we were supposed to say, we called this area the BU Beach. Like that's how people referred to it, the beach. And the tour line was like, if you close your eyes and you listen to the cars drive by on Starro Drive, it kind of sounds like waves crashing on the ocean. I was like, this is the most urban city school
Wow.
propaganda ever.
That's fantastic. Yeah, it's like right on the T. It's an incredible location to be right in the heart of Boston. I will tell you my fun fact, because I had a good buddy at BU, and I visited him multiple times on campus, and the dining hall was incredible. Like food, like fresh meat slice, like fresh omelets, fresh pizza. I was like, I want to live here and eat here every single day. So that was my incredible. You ate well while you're BU.
Banging dining halls for sure. The omelets were great. We had the soft serve machines. I worked at an ice cream store before I was in college, so I knew how to like do the soft serve, and that was also my special skill on
Oh,
campus.
so good. Number three for you, listen, this might be a tough one. Tell me the most impressive or inspiring person that you've ever interviewed.
That's such a hard question. I don't often get to interview athletes themselves, but I got to interview a lot of like the best women soccer players in the world this year for a certain story that I was doing. And I have grown up playing soccer, so I was just so starstruck by some of these people, like Brandi Chastain and Tobin Heath, Kristen Press, Brandi Chastain in particular. Like, normally I try to keep my cool when I interview an athlete, but when I was like got all my questions out, I was like, I geeked out. I just was like, I have to say, like, watching you play growing up, I was such a big fan. I would watch the national team when I was a kid and when I was in high school with my high school soccer team. And man, I just like she was so gracious and nice, but I really like definitely fangirled over Brandi
That is
Chastain.
awesome. So you fangirl over the athletes. I'd be like fanboying over all like the sports, the execs like CEOs and CMOs and whatnot. And Brandon,
I'm the opposite. I'm like, you're less cool than you think you are.
this should be a fun one here as well. Tell me your favorite journalist, past or present, to read.
Yes, I want to give a shout out to Molly Cahalane. I think that's how you pronounce her last name, but I think a lot of people who read sports stuff probably know her. She was at Adweek and she was at SBJ for a while. And I believe she's at a golf publication now, which I think everyone should read because whatever Molly's writing about, like, I think that's the future. And she did such amazing women's sports stories even before I started covering the space, before a lot of people were covering the space. And I remember reading her work before I like could ever have even imagined doing it. So I've always kind of looked up to her stories, and she's super smart and super fun, nice person too, which is always a good plus.
That's a great shout out. I formed a mini parasocial relationship further because she was like a co-host on the SBJ Media podcast. So hearing her voice every week, I was like, okay, I like this person, and I've read her as well quite a bit.
She's so fun. We watched the WNBA championship game 2 seasons ago when the Liberty won together. And it was like, oh my God, such a fun time. And also a little bit of a starstruck moment. I think we'd even met before, but like I just always love hanging out with her
That
and
is
her work
awesome.
is good. So shout out Molly.
Hell yeah, that's a good one. Number five, tell me, like, do you use generative AI or LLMs at all in your work? If so, how to use it, and also which tools are kind of your go-to?
I rarely do, honestly. I'm a really bad Gen Z. Like, I don't use even really TikTok. Like, I'm not very tech savvy. I don't use a ton of AI. I have always used a very basic AI service, which is Otter transcription service, to just it is like the simplest form of AI, but it is AI, just to like record my calls and do the transcribing. It saves a ton of time. Like I remember back in college, I would have to like record on my phone and then I would have to type up like the whole conversation to get the transcript. So that general, like my philosophy, which is very half-baked on AI, is that for writing and for reporting, like that sort of task, managerial kind of like admin stuff, transcribing, is great. I've never had a need for it anywhere else. Like, I love the process of sort of like writing, coming up with sentences. Like, I'm more of a writer, honestly, than I am a reporter. So I think maybe for that reason, I've not felt the need to use it much in my like story process. And I don't think that AI can like replace reporting. That is the most human thing in the world. So I don't use it a ton.
Never been tempted to like upload a transcript of the Otter has helped you write and ask ChatGPT like what are the main points here? Write an article based off this interview.
No, I'm too narcissistic. Like I said, I like to hear myself talk and I like to see my own words. I'm like, ChatGPT can't do this like I can.
I would agree as a reader of your work. I don't think an LLM can match you. Maybe in the future, who knows? But we're not there today. That's for damn sure. Number six, we mentioned this a little bit in the interview portion, but if anyone subscribes or reads, Morning Brew and Marketing Brew as well, like Morning Brew, I probably laugh at least once or twice every single newsletter because there's like a great like millennial like reference or something, or there's some, like it's a great way to read. And also as we allude to as well, like the stories that you write, I feel like I always learn something. So just tell me like what is sort of like the guiding principle or North Star for Marketing Brew in general from approach, language, etc.
Yeah, I think we did hit on it already, and I'll keep it short and sweet because that's basically our philosophy is smart, fun, easy to read, but really informative. And I think that's been something that's sort of like guiding through my career and definitely a core principle at Marketing Brew and at Morning Brew is that just because it is funny or it is quick or it is written in simple, common, everyday terms does not mean that it cannot be smart. So that's something I think about every day.
Is that different from like how a classroom would teach you today? Like you have to use very staid language and very impartial, and all, like you can't do anything that shows personality. Like is that the opposite? Not opposite, but is that much different than what I guess a standard way of writing would be for journalists?
It is. I think in some ways I was always taught like to use simple words, as few words as you can. Journalistic writing has and should be, I think, even in the traditional sense, always very straightforward. The personality stuff, like that's where I think that people need to modernize a little bit more. Like I said, like I would never put my opinion in a story, and it's so hard to do. I'm still figuring it out, and like it takes years to figure it out, but there is a way to have a little bit of a tone and a voice, and just some fun and some flavor without writing down your opinion.
Yeah, I even read like a recent Marketing Brew sports story now, and I was like, this doesn't sound like Alyssa. And I went and looked at the byline, and it was someone different. And I was like, oh, okay, I maybe.
I love to hear that. That is really nice. I'm glad that that comes across. And yeah, shout out to my team. I'm really grateful. I am the only sports reporter, and it's just like not a single person beat, but we're such a small team. And I get so much help, like especially around stuff like Super Bowl. So you'll see everyone's bylines on sports stories from time to time, which I am grateful for because there is not enough time in the day.
And people, I'm sure most everyone listening knows that Morning Brew, Marketing Brew, like, is one of the OG newsletter companies as well. And it just was really done a great job in that space. So what have you learned from your time with Morning Brew? You're also at Morning Consult for a little bit, which I think has a strong newsletter game as well. Like, what you kind of learned about newsletters in general? I know you're not writing a newsletter yourself. You're writing articles that are then excerpted in the newsletter. But what are you kind of learning from your time being at these newsletter, behemoths, especially Morning Brew?
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, most of my work is like writing the full articles, but everyone on the team is involved in the process of sort of like compiling the newsletter. I think it's a great model. I'm happy to work in newsletters. I think it's sort of a more realistic way that people consume media these days, and I'm not fooling myself into thinking that like everyone is reading the whole newsletter every day. I know personally like how hard it is to keep up with that stuff. But something I've learned at Morning Brew especially is in that vein, and what we've already been talking about is the value of making things like short and sweet and punchy and still smart. You know, like how do you tell what's that one or two or three sentences of this whole story that you can put in a newsletter format that is gonna A, ideally make people want to read the whole thing, but B, like make your peace with the fact that they might not, and that's okay, and you still want them to learn something from those three sentences.
Yeah. Do you pay attention, and do your coworkers pay attention to, like, what is the click-through rate on my story? Is that a win if someone clicks, or is it okay sometimes they don't click as long as they opened it and still read that excerpt, presumably?
Yeah, we pay attention a little bit. As far as I can tell, every team has their own kind of like philosophy on it, and we're allowed to have that. The higher levels, like my editor in chief and the company executives, I know pay very close attention to this stuff. But then they say to us, you know, like, how much do you want to know? Basically, my team, I think sometimes we look at the end of the year, the stories that got the most clicks. That's once a year that we kind of look at clicks. Other
Yeah.
than that, I think the stats that we like to check in on more regularly are the ones in aggregate, like how many people are opening the whole newsletter, how many on average are clicking through. So it's a little bit less of a competitive vibe, and more of like a how is our work all together serving the reader? And I think, you know, open rates and read through and stuff like that of the newsletter as a whole is a little bit more valuable to us than clicks on a link.
Right. Is it ultimately like you want someone to come and read the full, like, I think about this from from the context of like how you might package some of your stories for social first and for native consumption on social platforms. Like, do you have any say or any contribution how that gets packaged, and how is that success and that engagement happening off platform, off the actual .com, affect your evaluation success as well?
Yeah, we have an amazing social team, and we've definitely been branching out a lot. My team launched a podcast this year in September. We rolled it out, Marketing Brew Podcast. So that's one example. I have reluctantly done a few like social videos
Yeah.
at the guidance of one of our social directors. So that's another way, you know, that where I'm talking about some sports marketing stuff reluctantly on TikTok, but it's another platform for us to sort of spread the word. And then in my ideal world, someone might see that and then they might say, oh, cool, this is really interesting. I'm going to Google like marketing brew Lululemon NFL deal, and then you can read more about it there. We've done that. Yeah, we have different ways we package our stories, even digitally. You know, we will make sort of like a book approach, like if I've done it, or a series, a landing page, or like a downloadable PDF that's basically just our stories compiled together. I don't have a ton of say in this, but I think it's really smart. And we have other teams that are very focused on like what else can we produce other than newsletter and web articles.
Totally. Super cool insight into that. All right, coming down to the wire here with Alyssa Myers of Marketing Brew. It's time for our food question. Always ask a food question. Tell me, I guess I'll add a second bonus part to this. So first, the best meal to get in New York and where to get it. And then the bonus, because you spent time in Boston, what's the best meal to get in Boston and where to get it?
Ooh, okay. This is such a hard question for me. It's like impossible to choose. One of my favorite restaurants I went to this year in New York was Theodora Mediterranean Food in Brooklyn. I think it's like a popular spot. You got to get a reservation in one of those like trendy places. But oh my God, like it was probably my favorite meal of the year in New York. Boston, there's a really popular like bakery kind of like Italian place called Bova's that a lot of people know of, and I think very fondly back about Bova's. It's like a 24/7 place that I think is near the area of Faneuil Hall around there.
Nice.
But definitely shout out to Bova's. And then there's another place that's like a chicken and rice bowl place in Allston called Coriano's that was a mainstay when I lived around there. So yeah, Coriano's and Bova's in Boston and Theodora in New York.
I love it. We are definitely simpatico, you and me, when it comes to food choices. So I would have to look those up for sure. All right, number nine here. Tell me your. We may have discussed some of them, maybe not. Tell me your favorite brand or sponsor campaign sports that you've reported on. Also, if it's different, with the most novel or like unusual brand response campaign you've come across in sports.
I think it's one answer. We alluded to it, but I haven't talked about it explicitly. But Essie did a sponsorship of Ellie the Elephant this past year, I think in the spring. It was so cool. They like gave the mascot elephant a manicure, and I just thought it was the coolest thing. They did a lot of other content with her and other influencers as well. But man, like the way that, first of all, like Shayna and the Liberty have sold Ellie, like she has her own deals, her own brand book, like her own price list. She is an entity in and of herself, and I think the Liberty having like the flexibility to do that when she became popular and not just be like, oh no, you can only work with Ellie if you're an official Liberty sponsor, was really smart. And I think Essie, like, it was just so innovative because, like, why would you think of an elephant having a manicure? But they made it happen. And like,
So
Ellie is
good.
a fashion icon, so of course she's gonna get her nails done. And I just thought it was somehow like simultaneously the most surprising but natural partnership that could have ever happened.
Hell yeah, that was a great one. I went through a phase probably like a few months where I just was it just reading everything I could about Ellie. I must have read like 15 or 20 articles about her, but I just could not get enough. Just such a
Hopefully a lot of them were mine. I'm always like, yes, Ellie stories. Like I did one about they did something with Grimace, I think, a couple years ago, and it was like one of my favorite stories. I was like, yes, I'm writing about. It was so unserious. I talked to Shayna for it, and I was like, is Ellie the elephant in a relationship with Grimace? Like it was the most unserious thing I've ever done.
Oh, so good. All right, you mentioned a lot here. I want you to get you can get as specific as you want or as broad as you want, but we talked about it a little bit. So tell me, by the end of if we're talking at this time next year, what is the big sports business story or athlete story that we'll be talking about the most in 2026?
That is such a good question. I think that something we hit on offline a little bit is like some kind of motorsport being the next F1. I don't really like to say the next anything, but that's pretty general. Something in motorsports. Like, I think that's only going to continue to get popular in the States. I think obviously the trend of women's sports will continue. And like I said, I think some of these leagues that have only been around for a couple years, maybe this is a little more forward-looking, but like the more time goes on, I think the more we're going to hear about, you know, PVF volleyball or Love Bee volleyball or PWHL. And I think you hit on it a little bit too, but the third thing I would say that has not really come up in my prediction story yet or here, but I think about it a lot, is athletes as their own brands and their creators and sort of the power of athletes in a brand deal, which is pretty specific. But I think something for marketers to continue to think about is giving an increasing amount of freedom, creative freedom, business freedom, whatever, to your athlete partners, because they're going to expect it. They know their audience best. They have their own brands and businesses to think about more and more these days. So I think, ownership and athletes as business leaders and partners, as opposed to just sponsorship assets and kind of one and done things, is going to be more of a thing in 2026 and beyond.
Hell yeah, that's a great one to end on. I mean, the athlete story is so fascinating, especially in women's sports, where sometimes the athletes, the teams or leagues need the athletes more than vice versa, and that's not the norm in sports. And we're seeing that play out right now a little bit with like this showdown between WNBA and NBAPA. Like, we don't need you. Maybe we can just go to Project B or go to or just do Unrivaled. It's fascinating.
Yeah, and in soccer too, you mentioned it with like Trinity Rodman and Sophia Smith, like pay them whatever it takes, like you need these athletes probably more than they need you. And yeah, the WNBA CBA is just like another great example of it.
Oh yeah. All right, listen, you crushed it in the sidebars. Now your chance to take over the podcast and tell us your all-star follow. It can be a social media follow, it can be a newsletter, a podcast, whatever it is. Tell us who they are and why they're worth following.
I also would like to give a shout out to another newsletter company that I'm a big fan of, The Gist, a sports newsletter. So I bet a lot of your listeners probably know them, but I am such a huge fan for a long time. I've read their newsletters, I listen to their podcasts. They have like amazing recommendations on things like docuseries. They do such great breakdowns of every sport. I think they did like college football playoffs today, and they cover so many sports, not just women's sports, but they have just like a really accessible approach that I admire and find really fun and easy to consume. Follow them on socials. Like, I get a lot of my sports news from them on Instagram.
Great answer.
So yeah, I just think everything that The Gist is doing is incredible.
That is a great shout out. They do an awesome job. And then how about you? Where can we find you as well as all your work in Marketing Brew across all the platforms?
Yes, you can definitely subscribe to Marketing Brew and read my work there. That would be the first thing. Marketingbrew.com, and you can hit subscribe to the newsletter. You can find me on LinkedIn. I post a lot of my stories there, Alyssa Myers. And other than that, I'm pretty private on social, so I think I'll end it there.
Hell yeah, check out her work. If you follow me at all, I probably link out to her stories constantly as well. So it just it's so awesome to be able to connect with you and learn from you today. And we'll be continuing to read your work going forward. And thanks for coming on the pod.
Thank you so much, Neil. This was a ton of fun.
Gosh, I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Alyssa as much as I did. Just a tremendous opportunity to pick her brain and get to know her. And no doubt, you should be subscribing to Marketing Brew, the newsletter, and be reading her stuff, because I know I'll be reading a lot of her stuff in 2026 and beyond. Just so much good information and knowledge from her. And we appreciate her coming on the podcast today. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thanks again for listening or watching. I'm your host, Neil Horwitz. Find me on Twitter and NJH287. Also, hit me up on LinkedIn. Also, you can contact me and find more content on the website, dsmsports.net. And check out the podcast on whichever podcast platform is your favorite. We have 12 plus years of episodes and more to come in the year ahead. So thanks for listening or watching. This is Neil Horwitz signing off for the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.